It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, more states are requiring employers to disclose compensation levels for their workers. We'll find out how these pay transparency laws work and what they mean for companies, their employees, and prospective hires. First, there's a growing legal storm over Wisconsin's new legislative district maps, as expected. We are required by law to update those maps every 10 years after the census results to make sure representation is as equal as possible. But in anticipation that the Republican-controlled state legislature and Democratic Governor Tony Evers may not agree right away on new maps, both sides have already gone to court. How the various lawsuits play out could have a big impact on our 2022 elections. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the current state of Wisconsin's election maps? Do you think that they fairly represent the state? What would you like to see change? What do you think about the process we use? Do you think that there should be a negotiation between Republican lawmakers and the Democratic governor? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob.
Well, redistricting has been on your mind lately with the new podcast dropping on this show, among other places, tomorrow. With this current process, though, Sean, what is supposed to happen by law? What would a normal, quote-unquote, process look like?
I don't know what you say the normal process would look like, but what's supposed to happen, what has to happen, is that every 10 years, we count everybody up in the United States under the U.S. Census, and we use that information of how many people there are and where they live to redraw district lines. I mean, fundamentally, that is what we're doing every 10 years, is making sure that all of those districts are roughly equal in population, or in the case of the congressional districts, almost exactly equal in population.
I don't know if it's normal, but a typical process in Wisconsin when we have divided government is lawmakers come up with something, the governor disagrees, a court decides it. And here we go into the courts now, Sean. I think a few lawsuits going on. State Democrats filed one asking a federal court to step in the likely event that the legislator and the governor can't agree on a new map. Why are they going into a federal court there?
This is kind of a sign of where they want to fight this out, I think. I mean, this lawsuit was filed by Democrats the day after that detailed census data came out. So there was some speculation up to that point on where Republicans would want to be, where Democrats would want to be, knowing that this thing was going to get fought out in court this year with divided government. Democrats made it clear this is where we want to take our fight. Federal courts have had a hand in map drawing the last few times that it's been drawn by a court in Wisconsin. And in this case, they are going to a 3-judge federal panel in the Western District of Wisconsin. These cases go to 3-judge panels. And in this case, they drew a 3-judge panel with 2 judges from who were appointed or nominated by Democratic presidents, and 1 judge who was nominated by a Republican president.
Then the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, a conservative legal organization, asked the Wisconsin State Supreme Court to plan to get involved and take over redistricting in the likely event that the governor and lawmakers don't agree. Why would Republicans want to go to the state court system and straight to the state Supreme Court?
You have in Wisconsin a 4-3 conservative majority. And again, this wasn't exactly a given. The 4th judge making up that 4-judge conservative majority is Brian Hagedorn, who has definitely gone against Republicans on a number of high-profile cases recently, specifically election cases. So I think the prevailing wisdom is that Brian Hagedorn is not like a given in these cases, depending on what's challenged. But this is, again, a sign of where the parties want to be. In this case, it's not a party, but it's one of their allies, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, a conservative ally of Republicans, took this case to the court and said, if the legislature and the governor can't draw a map, Wisconsin Supreme Court, we want you to consider it.
And Wisconsin Republicans also went to the U.S. Supreme Court now to try to shut down the Democratic federal court lawsuits. They're trying to go straight to the top to block that.
Yeah, absolutely. And this would be unusual for the U.S. Supreme Court to step in and tell a federal court, don't do this, because federal courts have a long history of doing this. But you have different justices on the U.S. Supreme Court this time around. You have a 6-3 conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court this time around. So Wisconsin Republicans are giving that a try. They want to block that federal court action so they can handle it in state court.
Now, Republicans in the state legislature, they have the first step here. They have to draw some maps. Some leading Republicans have said, hey, we want to disrupt our current boundaries as little as possible. We want to honor current things and tweak them a little. How does that compare to their approach 10 years ago?
Yeah, compared to 10 years ago, they tweaked things. Tweak would not be the word, okay? They definitely changed things a lot. They're passing this resolution today in the legislature, and I think the key phrase is retain as much as possible. It appears in this resolution. I think that's the going theme there, is that Republicans want that map that they drew when they had single party control of state government in 2011. They want that map to survive for another 10 years. When they drew the map that year, they changed a lot. They moved a lot of people around in terms of which districts they were in. This time around, they're saying, let's keep it as is. That map has helped them preserve majorities for the past decade.
A lot of balls in the air here, Sean. When do we need a map in place to have an election? I'm guessing spring of next year?
You do hear some debate on this between attorneys for the legislature and, attorneys who are representing the Elections Commission, who actually have to, run that election. I think that one of the key things now that is on the calendar is that candidates have to start circulating nomination papers in April of next year. And the Elections Commission has said, actually, we would like to have this all settled by March of next year so that we can get ready for those nomination papers. Whether or not those are hard deadlines or something a court could move remain to be seen, but that's sort of the next thing, is circulating those nomination papers next spring. That's the key thing to watch for.
And speaking of deadlines, Sean, you've been busily working on one for Mapped Out, the new podcast. It's going to drop, among other places, here on Central Time tomorrow. Give us a quick sneak preview before I let you go.
Yeah, I mean, Mapped Out is definitely tied to the current redistricting process, but it's really an attempt to take a big picture look at, really, there's really no bigger deal in the Wisconsin legislature that's going to happen in this session or that happened 10 years ago when it comes to political power. So this is a look at how that comes together and how it came together 10 years ago and has turned what is, by most definitions, a purple state into a red state in practice.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. You can hear more from him, as I mentioned, tomorrow here on Central Time with Mapped Out. Maurice Shepard joins us now for more on the redistricting process. He teaches political science at Madison College. Maurice, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
Good. Well, let's pick up where Sean just left off, saying there's a lot at stake in this process. How big a deal are these maps for the next 10 years here in Wisconsin?
I think they're very big. In terms of redistricting, there's a lot of research about this. And the three big areas, I think, for everyone to pay attention to, one is competitiveness. When some individuals push back against the Republican drawn maps, they make the argument that because it's not proportional, the vote is not proportional to representation, that actually hurts competitiveness. A second area in terms of why this is important is public policy, in that these are the individuals that are, for the next 10 years, the individuals that will serve in the state legislature. I'll just focus on the state legislature here for a moment. They are the ones that will make public policy for everyone across the state. So it could be a policy such as legalizing recreational marijuana. I know that in terms of more recent public polling, they show that has a lot of, once again, public support, or tax policy. But the important point as it relates to policy is that policy is about what government does to serve the citizens. And the final point, third point, is political legitimacy, that Wisconsinites want to know that their government actually represents them and that these are the people that they select, not that the elected officials have selected them. And if you have a higher level of of faith in your government, in the institutions of government. Research shows that that provides a much more stable political environment. So competitiveness, public policy, and legitimacy. Those are important reasons. Those are reasons why redistricting matters.
Maurice, I've heard the argument that partisanship, extreme partisanship, can be driven by this kind of gerrymandering. For if I'm a Democrat in a safe Democratic district or a Republican in a safe Republican district, I've got no motivation at all to support a moderate in my party who's going to work to build consensus. Is there something to that?
The research on that, quite honestly, is all over the map. And actually, some of the research that I've looked at that actually provides, I think, probably the a clear explanation of this comes out of the, once again, European politics. But a lot of it, in terms of political polarization, a lot of it is driven. And again, one party does not have a monopoly on polarization. Mm-hmm. It's on the left, it's on the right, it's Republican, it's Democrat. But a main reason why this is driven is that for the political parties and the political candidates, quite honestly, they have been rewarded for their extreme behavior. It's easier to send a negative message out than it is to take time to craft a more positive message. It's easier to raise money with a negative message than it is, again, either a softer message or a more complicated message. So linking partisan gerrymandering to all the ills of politics, the research on this is mixed. It isn't quite as clear as maybe some would have us believe. But political polarization is part of it.
We're talking about redistricting in Wisconsin with Madison College political scientist Maurice Shepherd, and with you if you join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of our current maps in Wisconsin, of the process, the way we draw these maps? Do you want to see, as some have suggested, as some other states have done, some kind of outside third party, somehow less partisan group, organization, whatever, draw the maps instead of Republicans or Democrats or whoever happens to be in charge in a particular year? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about redistricting, including several lawsuits over redistricting here in Wisconsin, with Madison College political scientist Maurice Shepherd. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Do you think we should change the way we draw these maps in Wisconsin, or do you think we have a pretty good system that represents the state pretty well? Call in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Maurice, we've seen some other states have independent commissions draw maps in Wisconsin. Hasn't happened here in Wisconsin. What do you think of that as an alternative system?
Sure. Well, across the United States, there are three sort of methods for redrawing districts. One is, once again, the legislative method that we use here in Wisconsin. The second one is a commission where maybe a group of retired judges are appointed to serve, once again, to draw those maps. Third might be a hybrid, a combination of legislative and a commission. I think that what's happening actually right now in Wisconsin is that people have really latched on to this, and maybe this doesn't get a lot of attention, but at the county level, a lot of county governments are actually putting in place sort of non-traditional methods to redraw local election maps. Milwaukee, I think they have a brand new a county board of retired judges. Dane County, got a new, once again, group of board of appointed citizens. And Brown County is another one. I'm not sure exactly what they have in Brown County. It's a Citizens Redistricting Advisory Subcommittee. But the point is that Wisconsinites, those that are concerned about redistricting, they're not just sort of sitting around waiting for someone else to do the work. At the county level, at least, they're moving forward.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi. A few weeks ago, we had a picnic in Solon Springs for the Douglas County Republican Party. And a lot of us agree that our our state, our country is under attack. So we feel strongly that Republicans need to fight tooth and nail to maintain our majorities. For example, if the Wisconsin people had the opportunity to vote on these 15,000 refugees in Fort McCoy, we would not have supported that. But the Democrats got it done because of the governor. So we need to fight for our political interests at all costs to defend our country.
And at all costs, I want to ask you, Jeff, I mean, are you willing to sacrifice voting in some ways, representative government to... Oh, Jeff hung up. I'm sorry. I wanted to follow up with him some there. But it's not an uncommon attitude. I think, Maurice, our goals are important enough that we can stretch democracy a little bit to meet it.
Yeah, and I understand exactly where Jeff is coming from. That, and you can, whatever public policy issue you want, it could be immigration, it could be, again, tax policy, transportation policy. What's critical here is, and at the core of this is, for Democrats and Republicans, you know, once we get sort of the electioneering part of it taken care of, then we need to focus on actual public policy. I will say this, and not in a partisan or critical way, but I think for both the Republican and Democratic Party, in some ways, you know, we all need to get back to sort of first principles, right? What do you stand for? And putting forward policies that help all citizens. Again, political ideology is good, and there will have to be some polarization, I guess, there. But in some cases, some of the, once again, sort of the election redistricting lawsuits and that sort, they're important, but they're muddying the picture. What our elected officials are supposed to do is work for the people and not the other way around.
Let's go back to our callers now. Andy is with us in Appleton. Andy, hello.
Good afternoon. Pleasantries.
What did you want to bring up, Andy?
I was trying to figure out, with all the political movement we had for this big blue wave and electing Biden and senators that were Democratic, because we were so, as a voter, disgusted with Republican behavior and the policies that they had. It's kind of the emotion that was taking place at the time. And then electing a Democratic governor, and yet the Republican numbers in the state legislators went up. Now, I was trying to figure out why the blue wave didn't transfer to the local level, and the only explanation I ever thought of was the way the district lines were drawn, that my vote for the local legislators was pointless.
Andy, I gotcha. Thanks for calling in. And Democrats have pointed to narrow victories in many of those races. Andy mentioned a more substantial victory for Tammy Baldwin in her Senate race, but a consistent majority in the legislature for Republicans. Is that in and of itself, Maurice, a sign that the maps were skewed?
There have been a number of studies to show that, again, and this was a key issue in the Supreme Court case, Gill versus Whitford, I think that's the name of it, from 2018, that there's nothing in the law that says, or in the state constitution that says, election results have to be proportional to the vote. But there have been a number of studies, statistical analysis, quantitative analysis, that do point to a disproportion, overly so, one that wouldn't naturally happen. So there's evidence out there to show that, yes, in terms of the way that there is partisan gerrymandering in the state of Wisconsin, and even in the Supreme Court case that I mentioned a moment ago, the U.S. Supreme Court justices, they threw that case out because the plaintiff didn't have standing, but they did voice concern about partisan gerrymandering and the negative impact that it can have on, again, competitiveness, policy, and the issues of political legitimacy. So those issues are out there. The only thing I would say to Andy, once again, and don't give up hope, is, you know, things change. And right now, again, even though during this last census, Wisconsin's population only grew by, I think, 4%, there are areas of the state that are growing faster than others, particularly in the Madison area and the area between Madison and Milwaukee. The state doesn't gain an additional, I'm just thinking right now in terms of congressional seats, a congressional seat, but again, the population count changes, people move. And there's going to be, particularly in terms of congressional seats, Representative Ron Kind is retiring. Again, things change. So I would just say to Andy, you know, just hold on. You know, things aren't, may not be as bleak as they may seem right now.
Time for one more caller. Luke is with us in Green Bay. Luke, hello.
Hi. I'm Colin. You know, we're talking about gerrymandering and redistricting here. And my point, as I've been listening here, is essentially the current districting that we have. We know that the amount of data and things that have been crunched to create the districts we have, we know that they've created sort of an unfair playing field, you know. And I think whatever your political persuasion is, that as long as the sort of the playing field is fair and level, you know, we should be able to accept, you know, victory or defeat. But I think the problem with gerrymandering and where we're at currently as a state is that it discourages, you know, civic engagement. If people feel like they think their vote is worth something less than somebody else's in another district.
I gotcha, Luke. We just have a few moments left. Maurice, your thought? If the maps are skewed, it can lead to disillusionment.
Luke is absolutely on point with that. There are numbers of studies to show that if people feel that the election process, voting administration, that it's not, once again, sort of fair and even and just, they become disenchanted and participate at lower rates, if at all.
Thanks for that call, Luke. And Maurice, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Been talking to Maurice Shepherd. He teaches political science at Madison College. He was with us today to talk about redistricting in Wisconsin and several lawsuits right now over how new legislative maps will be drawn and who's going to draw them. Earlier, we heard from WPR's own Sean Johnson on the same topic. Tune in tomorrow on Central Time for episode one of Mapped Out, a new podcast looking at redistricting here in Wisconsin. Lessons, if any, from 10 years ago. Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at how a wave of pay transparency laws is changing the way companies and workers talk about what they're getting paid. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, when autumn leaves begin to fall, it's a great time to hit the road and look at the changing colors. Get advice on the best places to see fall colors and learn about the science behind the changing leaves. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. First, starting soon, employers in two states will have to begin showing applicants the salary range they pay for each position in the company. Connecticut and Nevada are the latest states to enact pay transparency laws. They'll take effect on Friday. California, Colorado, Maryland, and Washington already have similar laws in place, as do some cities, including Toledo and Cincinnati. Rhode Island, set to join the club in 2023. It all means that potential hires, in some cases existing workers, no longer have to guess what companies are willing and able to pay. That might sound like good news for workers. Some employers, though, aren't wild about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should companies have to disclose how much they're paying their employees to potential applicants, to their current employees? Do you talk about compensation with your coworkers? Is there a rule against it at your workplace, as there is in some companies? If you run a business, how do you feel about having to share wage info with your employees and potential hires? Do you want to see this kind of law in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Aki Ito is a senior correspondent at Business Insider. She covers the economy, the labor market, and workplaces. Aki, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
I know there's some variation from state to state or city to city, but in general, what is the intent of these pay transparency laws?
Sure. So the idea is to bring just more information to this incredibly important decision that we make in our lives. When you kind of think about it, right, when you walk into the grocery store, you know exactly what you're going to pay for that apple or for that box of Cheez-Its. And it's kind of ridiculous to think about it that you don't know how much you're going to get paid for these jobs that you're applying for. The idea with these laws is to bring more information to job seekers, to try to level the playing field with employers a little bit more. And also along the way, almost kind of shame employers into developing more fair pay systems so that they're paying women and men equally, and that they're paying white people and people of color equally too.
Well, you share the story of one job seeker in recent years. You, what did you run into as you were looking to change your job?
That's right. So I think like a lot of job seekers, when I was looking for a new job, I went through the normal process of going on Glassdoor.com, seeing what other people have been paid in the past, talking to my friends, my colleagues. But then at the end of the day, I just had to come up with a best estimate guess on how much to ask for. And I got the job and I love my job today, but 8 or 9 months into the job, I'm still not sure if I asked for enough money. I'm not sure if I left some money on the table.
And some companies don't allow their employees to talk to one another. So in these companies, you couldn't say to your coworker, hey, what are you making? I'm making this, right? These are company policies.
There are a lot of company policies out there, but it's actually illegal under federal law for employers to actually enforce it. So as long as you are a non-manager, you have the right to discuss your salary with other workers at your company.
What kind of jobs are most affected by these pay transparency laws?
I think it would be mostly in, you know, white collar professional jobs, just first of all, because there's a bigger range of what you could get paid with these higher income jobs. And also because I think in a lot of lower paid jobs, these salary ranges are already posted in the job opening.
And jobs that hire hourly, it seems like when I see postings for those, a lot of times the hourly rate is right there up front, right?
That's right. That's right.
We're talking to Aki Ito, senior correspondent at Business Insider. She covers the economy, labor markets, and workplaces. We're talking about what are called pay transparency laws in a small but growing number of states, saying when you apply for a job, the company can't keep the pay scale a mystery. It also sometimes covers current employees and transparency over who's getting paid what. Aki, what have been some of the biggest objections to these kind of laws?
So I think... what I hear a lot from employers is if we end up disclosing our salary ranges, in especially publicly in the job posting, then other employers will be able to see that and poach our employees. I don't think that's as much of a concern if everybody in the state is forced to do that, right? Then you're just kind of poaching each other's employees. So at least it's a level playing field. And employers are also don't like it because the public nature of this forces them to think really long and hard about whether their pay systems are fair. Of course, that's the whole point of this law, to make employers check that their pay systems are in fact fair, but they don't like that scrutiny.
I want to visit a couple of states here and how it works. You wrote about California's law where applicants aren't automatically given that info. If I apply for that job in California, I have to ask to receive it. One snag you saw in this law is most nobody knows about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've lived in California for most of the last decade. And, you know, given the nature of my job, you'd think that I'd know more than most people. But I hadn't heard of this law until I started reporting on this story. No one I spoke to, just kind of in my own circle of friends, had known about this law. And a lot of my friends told me, oh, I wish I'd known before I applied for this job.
And then we have this Colorado law that took effect in January. And this is a little wider reaching. What is going on in Colorado with this?
So starting in January this year, Colorado has required employers to post the salary range of every single job in every job posting publicly. And so this is a very radical move. No other state has even come close to requiring something like this before.
And here's a twist. What is a Colorado job? If I quit my work here and founded a company and started hiring and said, hey, you can work remotely from anywhere you want. Am I a Colorado employer under this job? Because hypothetically, somebody could apply from Colorado.
That's right. So this, the Colorado law applies to every employer who has at least one employee in Colorado. So as soon as you have one employee in Colorado, the law applies to you. And it's really interesting because this isn't something, remote jobs weren't something that most employers were really thinking about before the pandemic. This law in Colorado passed in 2019 in the before times. But now this, because of the shift to work from home in the pandemic, Colorado's law has, you know, taken on more importance for national employers as well.
I'm not hiring, so no, don't anybody send me a resume. We're talking about new laws in certain states that require companies to disclose their salary levels, what people are going to get paid. Aki Ito is with us, senior correspondent at Business Insider. She's been following this story as more states around the country do some kind of pay transparency laws, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Okay, you've heard how they work. Do you think this is a good idea? Do you think employers should upfront, either in their job postings or early in the hiring stage, have to say, hey, here's how much, by the way, we're going to pay you, or here's the pay range. What's it been like for you if you've tried to negotiate your salary? Has it been tough with limited information? You don't know what other people in your position make at your current workplace or the one you're applying for. If you're an employer, what do you think about this idea? When you're hiring, do you upfront say, hey, you make X amount per hour or this range? Or do you want to keep that till the end of the process so you know more about the candidate you might be hiring? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 to share your thoughts or your questions. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk about the growing number of states passing pay transparency laws. That means employers have to provide in these states applicants the salary range they pay for each position. They vary from state to state. Among the goals, trying to make sure that people are being paid fairly, they know what they're getting into, avoid wage discrimination, say, between men and women. Connecticut, Nevada, set to enforce their laws starting Friday. They join California, Colorado, Maryland, Washington, some cities around the country. Rhode Island, up in 2023. Aki Ito is with us, senior correspondent at Business Insider. She covers the economy and workplace issues, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Good idea? Bad idea? Do you wish something like this had been in place when you were applying for a job, maybe negotiating a salary if you were in a position where you could negotiate a salary? Would you want this information out there as you consider what jobs to apply for? And if you're on the other side of things, you hire people, do you like this idea? Do you have concerns about having to disclose this kind of information, maybe even publicly? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Aki, listing the states there, and it seems like there's a trend of more and more states are doing this. Is this something that you expect to see in more and more states over the next few years?
Absolutely. There is a law right now that's being considered in Massachusetts that I think is very close to getting passed. I've seen other bills up in New York and other states too. So I think this is a real trend. I think this is just the beginning.
And this is something that is happening state by state, not at the national level. Did you run into people saying, hey, this is something that Congress should tackle?
You know, that's a good idea. I don't know how it would work on the federal level, but at least on the federal level, it's illegal for employers to enforce kind of the gag orders, right, about discussing your pay. So you have that level of protection. But this is very much a state by state, even a city by city fight.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Emily is with us in La Crosse. Emily, hi.
Hi. I am just calling because I have a wonderment as an employee. How would employers deal with the fact that employees would then be able to find out that new hires were making much more money than them after they've been working at a company for an extended amount of time?
Oh, interesting question, Emily. Thanks a lot. Is this a concern people have had? We don't want our 10-year employee knowing what the new kid at work is making.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is an especially relevant question right now because the job market is so hot at the moment, and employers are doing everything they can to attract new candidates and sometimes just forgetting to take care of their existing employees. This is, if you get this kind of transparency, then as a veteran employee, you can look at those job postings and say, hey, this is unfair, and you can ask for more pay. That way, as an employee, you're kind of enforcing equal pay at your workplace as well. So that's the whole point of these pay transparency laws.
Thanks a lot for that call, Emily, at 800-642-1234. Digging around, Aki, I saw one concern raised that, okay, the idea here is that we're going to get more equal pay maybe for people in a position. If I know so-and-so is making more money than I do, I'll agitate to level it up. One CEO wrote, well, hold on. You know, maybe I'm paying employee A more than employee B because employee A just does a way better job. But if I had to prove that in a legal way or an HR way, well, that gets really difficult for me. Is that a concern you ran into?
I think a lot of employers do have this concern. Managers hate talking about salary. It's probably one of the most contentious issues that they can talk about with their employees, just because everybody cares about their pay so much. But I think the idea is that if you have a fair system and you also communicate that in a really clear way so that everybody knows why they're getting paid what they're getting paid, then it doesn't have to be such a contentious issue. If there are clear metrics by which you evaluate employee performance, you can justify paying some people more than others based on performance. So it really comes down to, do you have a fair system and have you communicated that effectively to employees? With both of those steps, transparency shouldn't be as contentious as I think employers expect.
Talking to Aki Ito, senior correspondent at Business Insider, about wage transparency laws in many states, a growing number of states now, requiring in various ways employers to disclose how much they're going to pay you when you apply, or maybe even make that information available to everybody at your workplace. Do you know what your coworkers make? Do you want to know? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Bob is with us in Richland Center. Bob, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Bob?
Well, my question is, how does it deal with benefits? The pay rate may not look so good, but the benefit package could be phenomenal or vice versa. So just because you see the pay rate doesn't tell you the whole story. How is it this idea dealing with that?
Oh, great question, Bob. Aki, how do these various laws deal with benefits as opposed just to the raw number?
That's a great question. I know at least in Colorado, the employer does have to know what the benefits will be, what the benefits, and I think also bonus as well. But there's some really interesting research showing that some of the biggest pay disparities between women and men, let's say in like the technology industry, comes from equity, which is a kind of bonus, right? And even if you require employers to disclose the base pay rates for jobs, if you don't require employers to also disclose how they award equity, then you could still have a lot of inequality in the workplace. So that's a great question. And I think a lot of state governments are still wrestling with this question.
Bob, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Aki, speaking of state governments, you write toward the end of your piece that there are substantially big employers who do disclose pay scales and where employee pay is public information, and that's many local and state governments. How does it work there?
That's right. So in most government jobs, you know – exactly what you're going to get paid before you even interview for the job. In a lot of cases, there's a clear range for each job, and you know, they make it very clear like what you need in order to get a promotion or a pay raise as well. So the government is a really interesting example of an institution that works just fine with pay transparency. They've had it for decades, and it's not a contentious issue in the government. So why does it have to be so contentious in the private sector?
An interesting point you raise in your piece, Aki, kind of tangential, but it struck me, even when we can talk about what we're paid, a lot of us don't feel comfortable talking about that. You write that you have a very small circle of people who you're generally willing to talk about what you're paid with. Why are we so timid about talking about what we make?
I think that's our culture. I think we're raised in a system where talking about money and talking about your salary is taboo. So we don't do it, even though I think in a lot of cases we know that talking about our salaries is good for us, that it helps us gather more information to argue for better pay, especially if we're in these groups that tend to get paid less, if we're women, if we're people of color. So I think breaking this taboo is a really important step in trying to get us closer to pay equity.
You note in your piece that in the many states where they don't have these laws, there are some private websites that try to help people get a sense of what pay ranges are. What is out there in a state like, say, Wisconsin that doesn't have this kind of law?
Right. So, I mean, certainly you can go on Glassdoor.com or Salary.com. There are a lot of salary sites now out there that try to, you know, give you a little bit of a sense of what these jobs potentially pay. But the interesting thing is, even if Wisconsin itself doesn't have a specific law about this, if you're applying for a job at a national employer, their practice might just be to disclose the salary if a candidate asks, even if you're not in one of these states that has a law giving you these protections. So I think it's worth asking, you know, maybe after the first interview or so, like, you know, would you mind sharing what the salary range is for this job? Because you might be surprised. They might actually tell you.
Aki, what are you watching for next in the story of wage transparency laws?
I think I'm definitely interested to see if more states pass these laws. For example, in Colorado, when Colorado came out with its rule about requiring employers to disclose salary ranges and job postings, some employers decided to try to exclude themselves from this law by saying, we're not hiring any candidates out of Colorado. It turns out that's illegal in Colorado anyway, but you can't really say something like that if, you know, 10 different states are requiring this level of disclosure now. If it's just Colorado, it's one thing, but if you have, you know, 10, 15 states requiring it, national employers just have to go along and be transparent with everybody. So I think we're really close to the tipping point here, and that's what I'm going to be looking out for.
Aki, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It was great to be on your show.
Aki Ito is a senior correspondent at Business Insider, where she covers the economy, the labor market, and workplaces. We talked to her about the growing number of states that are requiring companies to disclose employees' salary ranges with what are called wage transparency laws. Still time for you to share your thoughts on that idea. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll check out some of the latest news in national politics, including the approaching collision with the debt ceiling, what it would mean, and what it would take to avoid it. We kick off WPR's new Mapped Out podcast, looking back at the redistricting process that gave Wisconsin its current election boundaries and what it all means for the effort to draw new maps over the next few months. And we'll check out a Wisconsin project that gives us a new understanding of forests and wetlands, in part by the sounds that they make. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's a magical time of year where you can make your voice heard and your vote will be counted in one of the most hotly contested races in the country. To answer the question, which brown bear at Katmai National Park in Alaska did the best job putting on weight for the winter? Yes, Fat Bear Week kicks off tomorrow, and you can start reviewing the contestants right now. I found out about Fat Bear Week last year, and I mentioned it here on the show. Now it's back, bigger and better and bearier than ever. There are 12 contestants, including 435 Holly, the 2019 champion, and 480 Otis, who won the first Fat Bear Week competition back in 2014. You can go to explore.org/fatbearweek, that's fat-bear-week, to learn more about the contestants. It includes before and after pictures from skinny early summer bears to now. And starting tomorrow, you can vote in a bracket-style competition. If you decide to check it out and you cast a ballot, I want to know about it. Email ideas@wpr.org. Added bonus, at explore.org, you can watch live webcams of the brown bears in their natural habitats. Warning, I started watching a couple of them today. Almost had to cancel Central Time so I could keep watching. It's bear news that you can use. This is Central Time.